Local news, culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is a local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Well, there's another nationwide protest that's going to be observed locally. This time, it's happening right here in Liberty, New York, and it'll be happening at this time tomorrow. We talked to Ann Hart for all the details on the May Day protest coming up in the second half of the program. But first, we have lots of news to get to from the River Reporter, including an update on a big story that we've been covering in Pike County. For that, I turn to Ruby Rayner of the River Reporter, who I spoke to earlier this afternoon. Ruby, welcome back to the local edition.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's get started. You have an update on a story that we brought to listeners more than a few weeks ago, and I've been concerned about where this story was at, so I'm so glad that you have an update. And this is about the Delaware Valley School District. They were thinking about changing some of their policies in response to federal efforts to stop various DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, even at schools. And this raised concerns about existing policies to protect trans students at that school. Sounds like we have some more clarity of what the school's going to do now.
Yeah, so the Delaware Valley School District, currently, as of their most recent board meeting, that April 16th board meeting, said that there's currently no plans to change policies protecting trans students, but they are trying to kind of seek legal clarification on whether the school district is still in this contract with the Office for Civil Rights, the OCR, and this was this existing agreement that the school was in from, 2016. So they are not, they have no current plans of changing or rolling back any of these policies in place that protect trans students, but they are interested in kind of getting some updated information about this dated 2016 agreement with the Office for Civil Rights, which was prompted, as you said, by these recent Trump administration executive orders aimed at removing federal protections for trans people and rolling back, certain Title IX protections. So the kind of propellant of this was those recent Trump administration executive orders.
Right. And, we were talking to folks that were monitoring the situation, and the way that it sounded to me was as though there was a bit of a split on the Board of Education there about how to approach this issue. It seemed like some board members were more responsive and or supportive of these directives coming from Trump's executive orders than other board members. How did this break down, and how did they come to this decision, if you know?
Yeah, so prior to the April 16th meeting, there was, which we had talked about, there was a meeting where they kind of discussed these federal actions and what they should do. And some members of the board, Jack Fisher, Brian Fells, and Carl Will, advocated at that meeting from withdrawing from this OCR agreement. And just for clarification, this OCR agreement was a trans-inclusive policy that was adopted for the Delaware Valley school district after a 2015 discrimination complaint from a trans student, which then led to this 2016 agreement. And so at that earlier meeting, you're talking about this split, those three members of the board were kind of discussing withdrawing from this OCR agreement, citing concerns and referring kind of to these executive orders from Trump. But then after that meeting, there was, a planning meeting. And then at the April 16th meeting, the majority of the board, kind of rolled this back and took a more cautious stance. And so they're opting to request kind of some clarification around the OCR agreement, but have made it very clear that there's going to be no immediate changes. And no anti-discrimination policies are being removed. And that they, you know, this is not happening because there's issues within the district. There's actually, they said they've only received ever one locker room related concern in 2 years, which was resolved, they said, without further incident, but that because of kind of this prompting, because of federal actions, that they want to kind of check in with what this OCR agreement is. Is it even still in place? They don't know. And kind of get some clarification around that, not to, you know, jump to moving to trying to get out of it.
So for those folks that are concerned that the school might go along with some of these policies, there's a possibility that still might happen as they continue to explore this.
Yeah, I mean, they, at this current moment, they've been very clear that they're not changing anything. And one point of clarification I think that is actually really important is that this OCR agreement, even if they were to pull out of the OCR agreement, it doesn't, they have another set of policies. So the OCR agreement actually prompted perhaps some of the creation of those policies that they now have in place. But whether or not they are in this agreement, they have those policies. So that would be a separate action to change those policies. So it wouldn't, you know, pulling out of the OCR agreement wouldn't necessarily mean any of their current policies that are related to trans protections would change.
And
those are school policies that have, you know, they've already adopted
right.
separately from the agreement.
Right. We spoke about this with Triversity. I want to make sure I had the right organization. And Taylor James, executive director of Triversity, talked to Radio Catskill back on March 19th about this issue. And I encourage the listener, if you're at all interested in this story, again, about Delaware Valley School District in Pike County, Pennsylvania, we have the full interview is up at WJFFradio.org, and it's called Delaware Valley School District Reassesses 2016 Agreement on Transgender Student Inclusion Policies. And after about 5.5 weeks, it's great to have an update on this story. So I thank you so much for bringing that to us, Ruby.
Yeah, of course.
Now, you did a deep dive into what's going on with the homeless shelter. And this is for Sullivan County facing a housing crisis. What is the story with the homeless shelter?
So Sullivan County doesn't have its own homeless shelter. It hasn't, you know, for the past 10 years, it hasn't had its own homeless shelter. And so most recently last week, it was the latest kind of attempt to push to try to get a homeless shelter in Sullivan County, you know, for them to be able to house people. You know, there's about 80,000 people in Sullivan County, and they're, the Health and Human Services Commissioner John Little said right now they, you know, from time to time approximately have 300 people that are, that they're trying to shelter. And that's, you know, a large increase from during COVID, he said, which they typically had about 50 people. And so you can imagine, you know, not having a designated homeless shelter makes that very difficult. And so there was a 20-bed homeless shelter proposed for single men and women to be built in the town of Thompson, right on Petaluma Road. That's right by the county jail on county property. And so the actual proposal that was in front of the legislature to try to get this homeless shelter built was a long-term lease with Honor EHG, which is a nonprofit organization that the county's hoping would run and provide services at that homeless shelter. And the hook is they got to get this long-term lease approved in order for the county to be able to apply for state funding that would actually fund the building of the actual shelter. And because they did not get a supermajority, this long-term lease failed to pass. And so currently it is faltered. So Sullivan County remains in a similar position of no forward progress on shelter and kind of sitting with this pretty significant population of unhoused people, you know, amidst rising rates of rent and having no designated homeless shelter to put them. But there will be a revote. Nadia Reich, the chair of the legislature, said that there is going to be a revote expected because they really want to attempt to apply for this funding.
Why couldn't they get enough votes to make this happen? Like, what's the opposition like?
Yeah, so this just, you know, there's been multiple attempts over, like, the past 10 years for the county to get a homeless shelter. You know, Health and Human Services, you know, previous Health and Human Services directors have said this is a priority, and there's been pushback in the past, and there was pushback about this current proposal as well. And so there was a lot of public criticism at the hearing. You know, there was a couple of different Hasidic residents who live right on Petaluma Road who were fearful that having the homeless shelter there had safety implications. They were talked about concerns about kids, you know, being near the shelter. The town supervisor of Thompson, Reber, objected. He said that he wasn't told prior, and that, you know, he was kind of trepidatious about the fact that it was singles. It's a homeless shelter for single men and women, and kind of proposed, what about we focus on a family shelter as an alternative? And, you know, very clearly, one person said, like, how would you feel if this was in your backyard? And, you know, there was also people who were very strongly in support of this and kind of pushing back against the criticism. Kathy Crater from the Sullivan County Federation for the Homeless, she spoke in support of a shelter. There was two locations proposed back in 2015 in Liberty and in Thompson as well. And she reiterated kind of the same exact point that she made then, you know, saying that the need has only grown and that, you know, she's really tired of hearing this NIMBY quote, not in my backyard. You know, people talked about having a responsibility to others. And John Little, the commissioner of Health and Human Services, said that this is just such a longstanding complex challenge that the county's had. And they've been, you know, working to try to get a shelter, and they really, really need one, and spoke very, very strongly that he, you know, really appealed to the legislature, urging them to pass this. But because it needs a supermajority, they were just one vote short there. So it did have a majority of votes, but it didn't have that supermajority.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you got that quote from Kathy Crider there and could tell us what she was saying, because from the Sullivan County Federation for the Homeless, because when Patricio first told me about this story, when I hear, you know, homeless shelter, the first thing I think of is the Sullivan County Federation for the Homeless. So I'm just kind of interjecting that here as a reminder to the listener, the casual listener who may be making the same assumption that I did, that we aren't talking about the Sullivan County Federation for the Homeless still operating. It's still its own thing, but we're talking about a county shelter.
Yeah, and just, you know, there was an article back, you know, when this was first kind of heard, or when in recent times there had been real movement to propose a shelter in 2015 of Kathy Crater from Federation for the Homeless kind of talking about getting calls from law enforcement needing to place people, and her, you know, having to then refer them to Health and Human Services, who puts people in then and still does. The model that exists in Sullivan County is using a set of motels as this emergency housing for people because there is no shelter. And this has been documented, you know, from different kind of arms as really, really not a great model. This is damaging. This isn't good. You know, previous Health and Human Services commissioners have said this model is not good because there's not any oversight, whereas right in a shelter, in this one that's actually being proposed, this organization that would be running it would be there with 24-hour supervision. Whereas in this motel model, there isn't that same supervision. The model is also really expensive. It's become increasingly more costly because of the more people that need to be there. And so this used to cost the county from 2019 to 2021 a little over $800,000 to pay for these contracts with different motels in Monticello and Liberty. And now it's costing the county on average from 2022 to 2023 $1.7 million. So it's a big difference, and it's a big cost versus, you know, and, you know, the investment in building a shelter, and that would presumably save on some of those costs.
Right. Now, we don't have much more than a minute to get to this final story, but I do want to get to it. And there's a lot more activity happening at the Lackawaxen Rail Yard than there had been up until recently. What's this story all about?
I'll give you the short and sweet. In Lackawaxen Township, there has been some increased activity, rail activity. There's been trucks from local quarries delivering stone to that rail yard at Route 590 and Scenic Drive. And so because of the kind of increase in activity, which it's been largely dormant, recently, the rail yard did exist since the 1860s, but there really has not been much use of it until kind of recently. And because of that, there's been some complaints from neighbors and of the noise and the dust and stuff like that. And so there's a local website, SaveLackawaxen.com, created by residents to oppose what they call the industrialization of the historic town. But, you know, despite that, the company, SRS, who is actually just operating as a logistics provider and doesn't actually control the quarries or the rail cars, is simply there for transport. They're kind of trying to work with the town right now to come up with different means of kind of limiting some of the complaints from residents. So they tried to switch to quieter trucks. They're adding watering truck to control the dust and other things like that. So we'll see how the symbiotic relationship between the residents and this new resurgence of the business over there kind of plays out.
Well, it's good at least to hear that, the company is working with the town. I see that they also plan to plant shrubs, drill a well, and restrict their operating hours to kind of regular business hours with no weekends or holidays. So at least they're communicating. That's always good to see in communities. Ruby, I want to thank you so much for bringing us all this news here, and I'll let folks know that all these stories are up now at riverreporter.com. We've been talking to River Reporter's own Ruby Rayner. Ruby, thank you again.
Thank you.
When we come back, May Day in Liberty, protests are planned, and, well, that's tomorrow. We'll get you all the details right after this break. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I think you are seeing a pretty unbridled and confident Donald Trump, and I think that lacking any kind of a change in curtailing his power in any meaningful way, either by the courts or by Congress, you're going to continue to see more of that on a variety of fronts, not the least of which will be the retribution front.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
This week on Catskill Character, my guest will be Wayne County director and cinematographer Alexander Hancock. Alex will take us on a road trip out west, starting at Shenandoah National Park and ending on a cattle ranch in Montana. So join Alex and me, Donna Fellenberg, this Saturday. Alex is even going to throw in a trip to Ireland. I'm Catskill Character at 10:30 on Radio Catskill.
It's the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And it's still April, but not for much longer. Tomorrow's the first day of May, also known as May Day. And across the country, communities are coming together to stand up for workers' rights, immigrant rights, and democracy itself. Here in Liberty, protesters are planning to add their voices to a growing chorus of protest against corporate overreach, attacks on immigrant rights, and cuts to essential community services. Tim Bruno spoke to Ann Hart, longtime organizer in Sullivan County, on this morning's edition of Radio Chatskill.
Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
May Day has a long history tied to workers' rights. How does this local protest connect with that tradition?
Well, Sullivan County is full of working families, and all of the rights of working families are at risk with this administration. Families need housing, they need health care, they need fair wages, they need union protection, and they need safety in their community. And that's why we're here on May Day, or will be here on May Day, to point that out.
This year, organizers nationwide, as you say, are protesting the Trump administration's policy. The administration just marked its first 100 days in office. President Trump was in Michigan for a rally last night. What specific actions or policies have galvanized people across the country and here in Liberty to take to the streets?
Well, we recently did a survey of people who showed up to the April 5th rally, and one of the comments that people made more than anything else was the attack on due process. It was interesting to see that that was the highest rated comment, that people felt that they cared about that issue more than anything else. But, you know, that said, there are attacks on SNAP programs. There are attacks on Medicaid. There are attacks on all of this. We, you know, we've had our young farmer, beginning farmer program cut. We've had reductions in USDA contributions for food banks. We've had, we've had our community and prevention and intervention project cut at Extension. So these are things that have already happened here in our county, all of whom, you know, all of which help our communities. And so it's really about standing up for our communities, the people in our community, whether we're personally affected or not. We are a community, and we should stand up for all of our neighbors.
The nationwide, this movement's bringing together a wide range of communities, immigrants, federal workers, working families, as you mentioned. Is that coalition represented here locally as well?
I think it is. From the people who have signed up to attend both either April 5th or who will be coming on Thursday, I know in some of the communities and some of the Democratic communities, they're planning different actions and events that they can do to help their community, be it a protest, be it organizing for a food bank, be it a teach-in about issues that affect people. So people are really sort of standing up and beginning to figure out how to stand in for when governments are cut. We obviously can't replace the money. We have a budget that'll be voted on in New York State, and I know that they'll probably come back again once cuts continue. They'll have to go back and figure out what to do with the state budget, which, of course, is going to impact all of us. So this is ongoing. We really have a lot of uncertainty. I think people are afraid because they don't really know what's going to happen. They're just afraid of what will happen. And obviously, with immigration, we've seen U.S. citizens deported or really kidnapped, and that's really unacceptable. So we're at a crucial time in our country's history. We've lived through crucial times before, and it's our turn to stand up and do what we can to protect our communities and our democracy.
You mentioned that April 5th hands-off protest. There's the May Day protest tomorrow. Have you been seeing growing support from people who may not have previously participated in political protests like these?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Some of the comments that we had with people or who responded to follow-ups or had conversations, they've like, I've never done anything like this before. I don't know what to do. I just need this. I need to stand up. We get emails over the transom for the Democratic Committee as well, saying, I've never done this before. How do I help? What do I do? So there are people who really, who have been quietly living their lives who seem to feel that it's time for them to stand up, too, without any urging from anybody.
Nationally, some of the organizers have used the phrase, quote, we are the many, they are the few. What does that mean to you personally and to this protest movement as a whole, do you think?
Well, there are more of us than there are of them, the billionaires that want to seem to control our country and take and keep all of the wealth. They're modern day robber barons, really, and there are more of us than of them, and we have to show our power, our power in numbers, our power in people, and our power in beliefs in our government. And that's what we're trying to do, because there are more of them than us.
Organizers have also mentioned that the administration's
not... I mean, more of us than them.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Organizers have also mentioned that the administration is not just targeting one community, but many at once. How has that reality influenced unity behind this protest and unifying groups to come out and march and make their voices heard?
I think it brings people out of their own, you know, sort of little bubbles that, you know, we all tend to live in. We have our communities, we have our volunteer work, we have our work, we have our families, and I think it serves to bring us out of what are the places where we normally are and where we normally spend time and have conversations with people, and brings us out to realize that, you know, there are impacts that affect all of us one way or another, and that we are one community at the end of the day.
May Day has multiple meanings. There, you know, it's known as International Workers' Day. There's a spring festival and pagan traditions. It's also internationally recognized as a distress signal for aircraft emergencies. What kind of turnout are you expecting on May Day in Liberty? And what kind of changes or outcomes are you hoping will come from this protest locally and nationally?
Well, there's been a healthy sign up through we joined in with the sign up function of the May Day Strong People, which is that one of the national movements for May Day. And there's been a healthy sign up. Our experience with the April 5th rally is that people who sign up, some of them don't show up, but others who didn't sign up show up. So I expect a nice crowd. A friendly crowd, a peaceful crowd with signs and chants and songs. And really what we hope to accomplish is to keep people aware that they're not alone. You know, in Liberty, Liberty's one of the communities with a number of undocumented people, to show them our solidarity with them, that, you know, we are there to support them as well. Additionally, I think that, you know, the actions will come from people saying, oh, well, what can I do? How can I help? And then developing whatever those things are that fit their skill set, but also help our neighbors.
Let's remind folks when this protest is happening tomorrow, where it is, and how folks can get more information or get involved.
It's May 1st, Thursday, from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., on the corner of Chestnut Street and North Main Street. Or there's a scaffold there, so if it's not there, it'll be North Main Street. If the scaffold is still there, it will be South Main Street. There's parking behind Main Street, up and down South and North Main Streets for people to park, and we expect it to be a great time.
And before we go, just for those who are listening who may feel frustrated or unsure if they should get involved or how to get involved, what is your message to them?
Join us. Stand up. We will figure it out together. We will figure out what it is that we need to do. We will advocate for things that need advocating for. We have a letter writing phone call group in our group. They accept requests for letters on legislation or actions from our elected officials. They make phone calls. And they're very active in sort of helping direct us in that way. Most recently, there was a letter that's going out to our congressman to ask him to support a bill which would restore funding for the AmeriCorps group. And so we're trying to be positive in our, you know, in our outreach to our elected officials, to show them what we care about and to show them that we are there, that not only are we watching them, we're trying to help them along the way and let them know that the people are behind them and what they're trying to do.
And where can folks get more information about that? Is there a website or social media?
They can send an email to waos@myyahoo.com, and then we can connect them further from there.
Ann Hart, local organizer, helping lead the May Day protests in Liberty, New York, across the country. Communities coming together tomorrow to stand up for workers' rights, immigrant rights, and democracy. Ann, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. Take care.
Just a reminder that the protests in Liberty scheduled for tomorrow from 5:30 to 6:30 in the evening. It's supposed to happen at the intersection of Chestnut Street and North Main, but it could be South Main if construction interferes. There is a lot of construction and other work that's happening in and around the Village of Liberty. So just giving you that reminder again before we say goodbye, because this is the time to say goodbye. That's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. I'll be back here again with you tomorrow evening. We'll do it all over again. For now, stay with us. We got The Daily coming up right here on Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.